It's called Let's Keep the Flames of Hope Alive. Never let the fires die. Let's keep the flames of hope alive and never let the fires die. Take the lie of the lie.
Welcome to Never Let the Fires Die, the Alarm Podcast. Episode 20, The Strength Reissue.
I swept the floors of all my things. I've opened doors and let the tourists in. Days of wine and roses, high ministers, red roses, these days are gone. Let's
talk about this Strength live record that comes out on Record Store Day, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's a real photographic audio document of that moment in time in the Alarm's history when we were just coming to terms with how to play and perform the Strength album and incorporate it into the Declaration material that we toured successfully for a few years before that. It was the first time we'd really gone out on the road with a mass of new material that people were unfamiliar with. And I think that show was the first night where we really connected with the audience and the band all at the same time. There was nothing left behind then. You know, Dave was at his best. He'd really come of age as a guitarist. I was learning to play some songs without the guitar and just a microphone and let the band play the music and I could concentrate on what was in front of us, which was an absolute wall of Alarm fans in Boston.
This is Boston. Where was the Orpheum Theater in Boston?
Yeah, and I think the Orpheum was an amazing, you know, a lot of the Alarm's live music, when you think about it, has come from Boston, Electric Folklore. The B-sides for the Spirit of 76 single, which were amazing, were drawn from this concert recording.
Those consisted of 68 Guns, D-side, Knocking on Heaven's Door, correct?
Yeah, and Where Were You Hiding When the Storm Broke.
There
was a version of Howling Wind that ended up on the Live for Life IRS Records compilation of it.
Time.
right. That should have been your bad. That's my opinion. I think I wrote that here. That should have been your live, jettison superstardom.
Yeah, well, we'll be playing it this weekend at the Gathering in New York, and it's got that pulse, that sequential bass guitar punch going through it, which locked everything down so the band could move around that static point of content. And I think that the fact that there was a fixed point of reference in the sequencer, it meant the band could move sideways around it, and it just emphasized the power. And you've got to remember that the modern alarm is sort of built on that same foundation. At that point in the set, when we play it now, no one's playing bass, there's two guitars going. It's a really authentic representation of the origins of the band. And that's that moment that Howlin' Wind used to bring to those early alarm shows, which was always massive when we played it at festivals or stadiums, when we played it with Queen at Wembley. That was the high point of the concert. It really seemed to seep right through to the far corners of the stadium. It was the biggest stadium rock we probably ever made, to be honest. And that's the modern alarm is built on that moment, really. So when I hear that, I think, oh, yeah, that's where we're at now.
You know, you kind of discovered at the end of that of Declaration maybe what was the future. And maybe it was a difficult future to get your head around at the time, I guess.
Because when Alan Shatloff brought that pulse to Howlin' Wind, the version that we had live was very different, and it was all guitars, bass, and drums, and a lot of movement in the song. And Alan just locked it into that sequential thing. And he always said he wasn't trying to record the alarm as we were at Declaration. He was trying to record the alarm that we could become, and so he projected us into the future with Declaration, and I think we realised that to a degree with Strength, because Knife Edge, which is also on the Live 85 album, that had a sequential pulse running through it as well, along with a bass guitar, but that was derived from the same source of creativity.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, in to a lesser extent, a song like The Day the Ravens Left the Tower, not exactly the same, but has a feel that it's a spiritual cousin to that song.
Yeah, I think so. I remember the first time we ever played that at a soundcheck was when we were on tour with U2 in Europe. We were playing with them in Brussels and in at the Forest National, I think it was the venue. And I remember starting up the little slow 3-string chord that starts the song off, and it's very haunting. And then you've got Dave's counterpoint coming in behind it, and I can remember Bono running onto the stage, going, before I'd even opened my mouth to sing, said, "What's this?" You know, really captivated by it. I think it's one of those songs that's got a strong centre running through it, and that little picking guitar part anchors the whole song and allows the band as individuals to come forward. You know, Nige was playing Hot Rods, the kind of sound that Oasis made famous with Wonderwall years and years later. Nige was playing that kind of drum pattern on Day the Ravens Left the Tower, and that was, in some ways, probably one of his most adventurous ever drum tracks. Some brilliant drumming on Day the Ravens Left the Tower, because they didn't just play the beat. So it was the same with Dave. He didn't just play the rhythm of the song or the guitar riff. He amplified, and Nigel exemplified, the lyrical content, and they highlighted the story that was going on in the lyrics and the drama that was in the lyrics. And that's, again, I say, with that Strength album particularly, and that Strength tour, that was when the alarm was really at its best as a cohesive unit, all pulling together or all pushing each other towards the same creative goal.
And let's talk about, I know this is about the live record that comes out on Saturday. Hopefully this podcast will be out just before that on Friday. That's the goal anyway.
I'm sure it will, Steve.
So, but the Strength re-release, let's talk about that really quick, because the main album that was remastered, it sounds better than it's ever sounded before. And my favorite track, again, is now The Day the Ravens Left the Tower. I don't know exactly why it pops out, maybe because I never concentrated it on before. You know, I want something new. But the whole album, what went into remixing that makes it sound so, fresh and alive now?
Yeah, well, I think what you're hearing with the remastering of Strength is that Strength was one of the first albums. It, on the back of the cover, it had recorded digitally written on it.
That's right.
And it was recorded digitally. And then it was really downgraded to be a CD and an LP. It had to go through the audio mastering techniques that weren't as advanced as they are today. So I think the fact that we had these superb 24-bit masters that had never really been heard before, that's what I was able to pull out of the archive for this reissue. So you're getting a really pure sound as you heard it in the studio. And 80s technology wasn't as advanced as it is now to get that sound forward to the listener. And so you're actually hearing the first generation sound that we would have all heard in the studio that is actually better now than the mastering and the way we could share our music in the 80s, which was mainly LP-led when 85 came around. Strength was an LP. There was no CDs, didn't really come along till either Hurricane for the Alarm. So the mastering that you would have ever heard Strength up until this day, really, apart from the 2000 reissue, is from an analog source, which is a copy of a copy of the master. So this Strength reissue is pure, straight from the source of the recordings as they were mixed and created by ourselves and Nigel Luby and Mike Howlett, the production team.
I remember back when I saw you guys the first time at Cal State Fullerton, my sister going and chatting up Nigel Luby in the sound booth. And I don't know exactly what she was doing at the time, but I just remember the name Nigel Luby as, all through my, Alarm fandom when I was a kid, wondering if he was the guy who was making you guys sound the way you sounded live. So if he was the magician.
He certainly was. Sadly, Nigel's no longer with us. And when he passed away, he had his family donate all his live soundboard tapes to me and some of his outtakes in the studio. So it's a real treasure trove of material. And Nigel was very switched on in terms of, and he was very in sync with what we were trying to do as a band. He was another guy who was older than us, and he'd come from a background of working with Yes, the prog band.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd been an out front engineer for them. And he came to work with the Alarm, and he brought a sort of musicality with him. When we were in the studio doing the demos, we just felt very comfortable in his presence. We'd met him because I ended up needing to rent a room to stay in London while we were making the Strength album, and I ended up renting a room off Nigel Luby and his wife, and then Nigel started coming down to some of the rehearsals, and he got on the soundboard, and he immediately made the sound come alive. We did the demos with him, and we were so pleased with the demos, we asked him to record the whole album. That was intrinsic to the working with Mike Howlett, that he agreed to work with Nigel, because we felt comfortable with him. And all the outtakes here on the Strength remaster were really down to Nigel. We were just having fun in the studio, jamming along, and Nigel was the one, he knew we were hot to trot, as he said, and he switched record, and that's how we ended up with those, really cool, fun recordings of us playing Deep Purple and Golden Earring and T-Rex in the studio. That's all down to Nigel and his perception.
Yeah, I mean, the B-sides of the Strength collection here are pretty extensive. Stuff like Black Side of Fortune that never went anywhere but sounds fantastic on the
demos, yes.
On the demo, yeah.
And try to relate.
I mean, we were really proud of the demos, and when we made them, we just felt really strongly about the album. It would have been called Absolute Reality if we hadn't if we'd gone on to work with Jimmy Iovine as originally planned, but that never came about. So we stuck our necks out and said let's do it with Nigel. And you know, there's a couple of songs in there: Black Side of Fortune and Sons of Divorce.
I'm looking for love in a loveless world. Oh, I'm looking for love. I'm looking for love in this loveless world. Oh, I'm looking for love. I'm looking for love. I'm looking for love in a loveless world. Oh, I'm looking for love. Oh, I'm looking for love. Oh, I'm looking for love. Feel to be the sons of divorce, neglected and dishonored by the ones you love most. How does it feel to be the daughters disowned, the victims of the circumstance you never bore?
Which probably would have made the record if we carried on working with Jimmy Iovine, but
probably Majority too probably would have made that record as well.
Yeah, right? That's right. That's another one. And we went out on the tour, on the Absolute tour, and that's when the song Strength and Spirit of 76 came into being during that touring period. And they knocked a couple of the songs out of the contention. And sadly, we never really got around to recording Black Side of Fortune. But I think the demo sounds amazing anyway, especially now they're mastered and we're hearing them from first generation tapes rather than bootleg quality demos which might have been sent to a producer and then found their way into the public domain years later.
Right. You know, I know it's fun to speculate that, you know, what would have happened in Jimmy Iovine and Black Side of Fortune and Sons of Divorce and that stuff, but, you know, it may be in hindsight better about what did happen, because the Strength record sounds so good in comparison. You know, the songs that made it on it, although I will say I wish Absolute Reality was on the UK version, but I understand why it was not. It sounds so great. I think maybe that those unfortunate losses led to a lot of great gains that you had.
Without a doubt, you know, what would the Alarm perception be without songs like Strength and Spirit of 76? I know that they're omnipresent a lot of the time when we play, and they can get taken for granted, but they're such cornerstones to what the Alarm is all about. And, you know, the Alarm Strength album would have been, I think even Eddie McDonald said it in the sleeve notes, that he always felt like Strength had the best songs of all the records we made, and I agree with him.
And it sounds the best too.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because to me, when I was listening back in years gone by, I always thought it was time-stamped more to the 80s than it actually is. When heard the new remasters from the real source, I was, you know, when we remastered in 2000, I was trying to make it as interesting as I could for the box set collection, and so used slightly different mixes of some of the tracks, like Walk Forever, and we played around with some of the different mixes that almost identical, but they were met at that point. They were really from the masters that led to the original cuts. Whereas Strength, this time I went back to the masters before they were compiled. I went back to the individual mix tapes and pulled them up individually, because when they were compiled, they were going down a generation to be mastered. That's how it worked. Whereas I was from the actual first generation this time, and I think there's a certain amount of clarity there that makes sense of the whole thing. And because it's mastered with modern ears, Pete Marr, who mastered, you know, draws out the guitars that more rather than the high end.
But I need to believe it's hard to define. When some say the future is unwritten, some say the simple things in life are the best.
when all is dark and dusty down the tracks, and all pass from exile. Every block's on all point saying no, no way out of here, go back to from where you came. And some say when you're down, you fight the hardest, some tighten the belt, while others let go. Someone said, you don't ask, you don't receive. Someone show me that, written down in the back of a book. And as I reach out and see my life unfold, I tell you this, because I truly believe in it. Ask me, have you received my friend? See, can you shall find? Oh, won't you help me now? Only the thunder knows what does a man in his darkest soul. Fortune and poverty, yeah. Oh, so close, oh, so
because when you were mastering in the 80s, you were mastering for record, and you added top end, you know, brightness to it, because you knew when the record was pressed into the plastic, it would, that process dulled the music slightly. So you overcompensated by adding top end to your mastering. And so we were able to compensate that in this day and age, take that brightness out. And bring out the tones that where you hear Dave playing at his best, and you can hear Nigel's bass and Nigel's drums and Eddie's bass guitar more clearly than the bells and whistles that we're known for in the 80s that were often put in to attract radio producers' ears.
Right, because it needed to sound, the radio guys needed to find something that sounded like the last song, it would sound like the next song, and not sound so different that they would get in trouble for playing it. But I think the only mashup I wish that happened was, I would like to hear how Tony Visconti would have produced these songs.
Yeah, well, I think when you hear what Tony did with Change, he really recorded as a live band in the studio, kept it very simple. And I was talking about this the other day with a Swedish podcast, but I find that when we came to make Change, we had some options of production routes to go down, and we nearly worked with the guys. I can't remember their names now, but they were the production team behind Faith No More. And for The Alarm, it was the first time we met people who could help us to go forward, who were actually younger than ourselves. Up to that point in our history, we'd always been the young guys in the room when we met the A&R man, the manager, the record producer. All of a sudden, we had some guys coming into our room who were younger than us, and their focus on the Change album wasn't on the songs we thought were the contenders. They were more interested in things like Breaking Point and How the Mighty Fall. That was where they were coming from, as the big songs. And
I like those songs. I somewhat agree that those are great songs. Now, Falling Down the River was a huge hit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was a huge hit, but again, as we've talked many times, you and I, Steve, it took us out of the alternative. It made us sound like much more of a mainstream band, and I think we worked with them. And Tony made us sound mainstream and very acceptable as a clean-sounding rock band, whereas I think at that point we probably needed to mess it all up and muddy the waters a little bit and find a way to attack the 90s together.
And Breaking Point is one of my favorites. I mean, it really is a great song.
And in the morning, do you remember the night? Put on dark sunglasses to shut out the lights, shut out the pain, shut out the red in your eyes you hide. Every time you look in the mirror, how do you live with your life? Ooh, ooh, you're at the breaking point. Ooh, ooh, just one step away. Ooh, the breaking point.
It's a great track, and I think, you know, that was really recorded almost as a B-side. You know, when you hear the demos, and that'll probably come along at some point in the future when we reissue Change, the demos and the album are not that dissimilar. There's not a lot of movement from the demos to the album. They're just recorded better with real drums rather than drum machines, but pretty much they stay the same. And I sometimes think if we work with younger producers, they might have really pushed us on into another realm, which some of those songs were hinting at, and possibly could have created a more solid foundation for more years for the original lineup to have stayed together. You know, when you hear the last two songs on the record are Rivers to Cross and then New South Wales, and they're hinting at something completely different than you get from the opening cuts of Soul Working Man Blues, which are really rootsy rock and roll records. Whereas when we were, you know, and as are Rivers to Cross and New South Wales in their own way as well, but they're from a different genre of music. So you do get a massive shift in change, as the song title says and the album title defines, in that record. You go from one extreme to another. And, you know, the world was changing all around us at that time. The Berlin Wall, there was a whole lot of things happening in Europe as they are now. So it's an interesting record to go back and look to. And I'll probably start that journey into the heart of that record this weekend at the Gathering, then, when I play the songs on the Friday night.
Well, you know, I mean, we got far off track. The problem is I could do this for hours and go far off track and talk about everything, because it's so much fun.
That's what the podcast is all about, Steve.
Let's swing it back to Strength for a sec. So the reissues are out. You've got this live record that is coming out on Record Store Day, which is this Saturday. A document of a particular place and time for the Alarm. And I have to say, the fourth disc to me is probably the fourth side. Sorry. Probably the most amazing of this entire set. I don't think I've heard The Chant Has Just Begun on a record before like this. The Chant plays to the strengths of this recording.
Yeah, well, it's mixed to how we played that night. And you know, the audience sound amazing. The band sounds great. But at times, you know, we were getting so into the performance that maybe, you know, our playing was going off a little bit, and some of the guitars had to be ducked for the tuning and things like that. And interestingly, the B-sides that were pulled from the record were mixed at the same time. But Dave redid his guitars for those B-sides. And that's why the mix, the guitar in the mix for the B-sides of Spirit 76, which you can hear as they were released on the digital versions of the album that you can hear on Spotify and iTunes. But to protect the integrity of the album, we stayed with the performance as was on the night, with no overdubs. And so that's why it was mixed that way in the studio in LA after the original gig. And we only had time. Dave, I think probably if we were releasing the album in 1985 or 86, we'd have redone the whole guitars for the album rather than just four or five tracks as we did at the time. And we thought, oh, we'll leave the whole album intact as it is. So I toyed with adding in the B-side versions into the running order of the album and replacing them, but they sound a little bit too different. And I thought, well, you've still got them. They're still there on the digital versions as they were released. But this, you get the whole feel of the album. And I have to respect that some people, they don't want pure, clean, in tune, you know, tidied up Alarm. They like the rough edges. They like the energy that was created in the dynamic of the moment. And I think this is the first real Alarm record, live record, where it is literally the truth of how we sounded in those gigs. It's honest. It's straight ahead. There's not one overdub at all. You know, with Electric Folklore, that was, you know, taken out of sequences, little tidy ups made in the studio in New York after the session. But this record is pure and simply the Alarm at its height in 1985 with an amazing audience in Boston. And that's, it's historic for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a document of a place and time. And I think it also, you know, I'm looking at the track listing here. You start off with Majority.
Yeah, and again, it's great for that, because that was such a powerhouse for the Alarm shows when we played it live. And we've never released an Alarm ad with that on it. I mean, there's some interesting things. I mean, in the middle of Third Light, you can hear all the First World War machine gun sounds going off. And I sometimes think, wow, we'd never get away with that in a concert today.
No, I love that. I always loved that. When I was listening to those, when I was collecting live tapes back in the 80s, I loved hearing that one.
Yeah, it was very visual. And Bobby Troman, who was doing lights for us, you know, all the strobe lights would go off, and it was really effective, and it created a real drama in the set. You know, especially in those days, productions were simple. You know, bands didn't have screens to play with then, or all the kind of LED lighting that we have now. You had to be creative with graffiti or with backdrops or with pure simple black and white lighting, and that was again the production we had on that tour was enhanced by that element, things like that, and the acoustics sections where we just drop things out or come back on one by one, and Dave and I'd have a little guitar harmonica battle before the stand.
Oh, yes.
They're the things everybody remembers from the shows.
This is one of the first shows from the Strength Tour. Yes?
Yeah, no. it was early. It was November the 9th in Boston. And I think, again, like I said earlier in the interview, it was really when we just really started to realize the power of the songs we had on the Strength album. It was the first time when we knew Spirit 76 was going to be something we'd be playing for the rest of our lives, like Blaze of Glory or 68 Guns. We knew it was right up there with those. And so there was a lot of, we were coming to terms with the power of the songs. And I have to say, at that time, Dave started to come of age as a guitarist.
You actually say that on the record.
Oh, is that right? I meant it. You know, he was. I mean, at the time, he was so good. And he would play right on the edge of the stage and be sweat dripping from every pore of his body. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm going to have to step up my game to keep up with this. He was, you know, Dave was stealing the show at times. He was that good.
he was actually stealing the show somewhat back then. True.
Yeah, you know, the guitar playing on Dawn Chorus, on Ravens, you know, it was sensational on Strength. You know, I think the Strength album really highlighted what a great guitarist Dave had within his personality. And he was certainly at his best at that time, and probably peaked when he hit the UCLA show. And you can really see how much skill. Funny enough, James Stevenson and I were listening to that show the other week, you know, and James saying, wow, you know, Dave's playing at that point was incredible. There was so much respect for him as a guitarist at that point in history.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the bookending this with the Spirit of 86 show is interesting, because this shows you guys trying to figure out, like, what actually is going to come next. And Spirit of 86, with your short, you know, you only had, 75 minutes or whatever to play, you really had to make some tough decisions about what to leave out. And it shows really what you decided was the point of the band at the time. Because here you've got One Step Closer to Home, the full band version as well, which I think this is the only time that came on a live record as well, right?
As far as I can remember today, right, that's I think it's been on a few bootlegs, but that's really the first time, apart from the Strength remastering, where you hear the electric version of One Step Closer to Home as it was defined and played by the whole band, yeah.
This man here is one of the fastest developing guitarists in the world right now. This is Dave Sharp. How you doing? This is going out on the radio. How you doing? This is called One Step Closer to Home. No pain, 'cause there was none.
in the wind, taking anything like seven roses, and it was alright. Turning down the cutting hand, he just could not understand. He run away, playing pretense for defense, or playing innocent. Said that's alright, the harder it bites, what's that closer to home? The deeper it bites, I want that closer to home. You can tie my hands, or with my back, I can't get it to the sky tonight. I may get lost, I want that closer to home.
Yeah, it's great. And then after that is Third Light, which you described, which, by the way, is amazing. Like, that's, I wanted to say that One Step Closer to Home was the highlight of side two, but I think Third Light is.
First light, the sniper saw you. Second light, took careful aim. Third light, you pull that trigger on a gun.
That was when we started the band. That was one of the first songs we played that we thought, oh wow, we've got something here. This is way ahead of what 17 was by a country mile. And it was always a great delivery from Eddie. And and the interplay between the guitars and Nigel, you know, that was where the band was really at it, very interesting at that time, because we weren't set up like other bands. There wasn't a traditional bass player in the band. Everyone could play guitar and wanted to be guitarists. And I'm playing bass on the Third Light, and Eddie and Dave are playing guitars. And I think it's me playing electric on One Step Closer to Home, you know, and Dave, because Dave was playing acoustic. So we were really swapping around all the time and getting up to all sorts. It was, you know, that the interplay and the call and response from the drums and the guitars. That, again, I can't hasten to emphasise enough how much we were working together as a unit on the song arrangements. And there was no politics of it's my song, I get to sing it, or I'm playing guitar. It was, let's just do what's best for the music at all times. And that's when we were, the Alarm was at its most powerful.
And I think no better is that shown than in the second half of 68 Guns on this side of the record, which it may be the definitive sort of arrangement of that song being played live that I've ever heard.
In the city of Boston, Massachusetts. Can I hear the crowd roar? Search me out. Down in the subway, can I hear that whisper? Through all the rage and glory of the years, we never.
never once thought of the fears for what we'd do. Well, nothing lasts forever. It's all they seem to tell you when you're young. But I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it. Come on. Won't you show me your hands? I see your shine. Yeah, yo. Yeah, yo. Yeah, yo. Yeah, yo. Yeah, yo. When you're young, I blew it.
Exciting, and again, that was a song that was really coming of age at that point, you know, and it's probably at its freshest at that point for everyone. And it was always a great song to, for any band to have a song like that in your set. You can't go wrong. You know, even when we play it to this very day, we just played 3 sold out gigs in Norway, and the fans went mad for that one. You know, that's a big song no matter where we go around the world. But at that point, it had really come into its own then. As beyond just being the song that was played on the radio, I mean, that's where it gets its legacy from. You still hear it on the radio, but it's only a 2.5 minute verse chorus guitar solo chorus song,
right?
But live, it's got a whole drama in the middle section, and that is so good. It always elevates it, that song.
Oh yeah. So on side 4 we've got The Stand, which you described. You know, Dave does in some intros, and you do a harmonica intro, which I also remember from the time really thinking was cool. The Stand plus Bound for Glory here, that's I wanted to see how long it was, but it feels like it's half the side of this record.
Yeah, it's, I think when I heard it back myself, I thought, wow, was that a mistake, or was it was so off the cuff, without a doubt. And I think It might have been Eddie who led us into that. I think I was finishing the song, and I think Eddie must have. I was probably almost halfway off the stage, thinking that's the end of that part of the set. And then I think Eddie started up Bound for Glory, and that, again, it just shows you that things could have happened from any quarter of the stage at that point. And in that moment, you can hear the band is learning how to play in front of so many people, learning how to cope with expectation, with the fact that people are coming to see your shows, you know, knowing and wanting to be blown away, and you've got to deliver night after night after night when you're on these long tours, hardly any sleep, doing radios in the morning, sound checks, interviews, and then you've still got to get on stage and deliver. And you can really hear the band is in its element, is thriving in that environment.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see. I feel like I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, 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 knocking on heaven's door. Mama put my guns in
when
the ground.
Releasing the Strength album, and we'd been on the Absolute tour. We played Knocking on Heaven's Door quite a few times, and we said, obviously it's played on Live 85 from Boston. And the guys who were promoting our records, certainly in the UK, MCA, as the distribution company, they were saying, Mike, you really should record Knocking on Heaven's Door. Your version is amazing, and it would be a huge record. And we were thinking, no, we can't do a cover version. Let's stick to our principles. And lo and behold, Guns N' Roses do a cover, and it's a massive hit.
Now, their version is closer to your arrangement than Bob Dylan's arrangement.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I have to say, we were, you know, Knocking on Heaven's Door gets played a lot by a lot of people, but we were one of the first bands that really brought it into the live arena. And before we played it with U2, whenever we played with the Bell Stars or the Beat, any band that we had any contact with, Boomtown Rats, and someone would say, let's do a song together, we'd say, let's do Knocking on Heaven's Door, because it's easy, three chords, you can't go wrong. And so I think that the legend of it spilled out, and I don't know why Guns N' Roses chose to do it and do it in the way they did. Maybe they have some association with somebody who said, hey, The Alarm do this cover of Knocking on Heaven's Door, which they never recorded, you should have a go at it yourselves. Who knows? I'll have to ask Duff McKagan the next time I see him.
It could be. I mean, I want to make a connection that's probably not there, but it did seem weird to me, because after I'd never heard the original before I heard yours, and it sounds, yours sounds, I'm not going to say nothing like the original, but very different.
Oh yeah, it is absolutely different. Yeah, and you know, and even U2, when they used to do it, you know, we stopped doing it because U2 carried on doing it after we taught them how to play it, and everyone thought we were copying U2.
Of course. Story so of like, many lives at this point, I think. But
it's one of those songs that gets passed on, and you know, I think I've got a feeling that in actual truth, I think U2 might have played Heaven's Door really early in their career with the likes of Pete Wiley from the Mighty Wah coming on stage. So, you know, no one could really lay claim to who played it first. It's the same with Rockin' in the Free World, you know. We did play it before. Neil Young and Big Country did it, and Pearl Jam. And it's just one of those songs that everybody plays. And
so, yeah, I mean, it's essentially it's Bob Dylan's song, you know, Sour Grapes for me, because I would have rather your guys' version get more popular than Guns N' Roses' version. But obviously, that's what happened.
That's life.
So this record store day, you'll be in New York City on Record Store Day?
Yeah, I could be playing at Generation Records in the Village at 1 p.m. It's not far. So it's a 5 to 6 minute walk from Irving Plaza, where we're going to be playing that night and throughout the weekend. And lots of fans coming over from the UK to spend the weekend with us in New York, and people coming from all over the USA. And I think the fact that we're doing the Record Store Day at the same weekend with Gavin is just enhancing the excitement and the anticipation for the event. And I'm just going to be playing at the store myself, because I'm the only person that plays on Live 85 who's connected right. to Elam in the band at the moment in time. So it just felt right that I should go down and be the one to sign the records. We're doing a live broadcast from Sirius XM on Friday morning at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. And that's going out all across the USA, and it gets played at 10 o'clock on the Pacific Coastal Time. So you'll be able to hear it, Steve.
Oh, yeah, cool.
We're on Feedback Channel 106 with Sirius XM, and we'll be playing three songs live, which get broadcast right across America. So it's really exciting. And, you know, we've got the summer tour coming up as well, as around about 40 dates going to take us right across the USA.
Right. There's no LA gathering this year, right?
No, because we just didn't have time, and we got asked to play by Richard Blade, the Sirius XM DJ, to play at the Microsoft Theatre.
Right.
And Richard has been such a supporter of the band that we couldn't say no. And it's like a Top of the Pops type gig. It's like something we would have done in 1983. So I think it's really interesting to play with some of those bands. We played at Richard's behalf. A festival called Like Totally in Huntington Beach just over a year ago, around the time of the LA gathering. And I wasn't expecting a lot from that gig, but we absolutely blew the place to bits. And I think that's the reason why we sold out the gigs in San Diego and in San Juan Capistrano. And so I think playing the Microsoft Theatre is a great opportunity, like Top of the Pops was for the band.
Yeah, I mean, your job is to blow everyone away there. I mean, that's really have to do. So
we're going to play in front of 6,000.
I'm giving you a job to do. And it's...
Yeah, we're going to play in front of 6,000 people, and we're going to own the place by the time we finish there, I can tell you. And it's great because it builds our audience. It takes us into the places where people don't expect to see us, like when we did the Vans Warped Tour. This is just part of rebuilding the connections that we've been fortunate to create throughout the history of the band, but to remake some of those connections that help build and ground us for the future. So it's great. So we couldn't do other shows too close to that in LA.
Yeah, no, I figured that's exactly what the reason was.
Yeah, look, it's the whole world is changing. You know, we've got when we come on the Sigma tour in the summer, we're going to be running a massive social media campaign. We're going to be doing some songs live every night on the internet. We're going to have a host on the stage interacting with the audience who aren't even at the gig, who can send in tweets and messages, or you can tweet from the floor of the auditorium and let us know where you've come from, and we can acknowledge that. We've got a mass of ideas that we're looking at to explore on this tour, because nobody knows where your audience is these days. It used to be make a song, get it played on the radio. Well, that's gone, you know. So now it's a whole new frontier, like it was in 1991 when the internet had arrived. And we how do we embrace that? We don't know. We're going to make some mistakes. We're
going to figure it out.
Yeah, we've got to figure it out, and we're going to find some happy accidents that are going to propel us into the future. So who knows what's going to happen on the Sigma tour. It's going to be so exciting. You know, we've got pre-show events where people can come in and see an acoustic show before the tour. They can ask some questions about the album. They can have their own podcast if they like. We're going to be broadcasting a lot of things live and using all the social media platforms and others and some that you think are only static platforms. We'll be working on those to make them live and exciting on the days. So I'm really enthused about how our music can be transmitted and communicated in this day and age. And it's a level playing field now. We can be as good and as ambitious as we want to be, and that requires a lot of hard work and a lot of effort. And I've got the energy for it. I'm, you know, past the milestone age this year. And I think I need to change my Wikipedia and put it back a few years.
I stood on the change in our guards to the bloody tower, watching the crown jewels. A penny for the geyser. Will you vote left or right?
Hello, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. So this is our quarterly podcast.
Excellent. It certainly is.